Adventures of a Trailing Spouse. It's by a lady called Bridget Keenan, who, it says on the back, was a glamorous, successful young London fashion journalist, but falling in love with a diplomat, saw her leave behind the gilt chairs of the Paris salons for a large chicken shed in the forests of Nepal. 30 years later, at the farewell party for the papal nuncio in Kazakhstan, Bridget found herself wondering whether her decision had been the right one. This is a hilarious account of her life as a trailing spouse, an engaging tale of diplomatic protocol, difficult teenagers, homesickness, frustrated career aspirations, witch doctors, and giant jumping spiders. Joanna Lumley at the front says it's just fabulous. And William Dalrymple on the back says, I find myself laughing out loud 3 or 4 times a page. It's a great read. But it has its serious moments. And at one stage, she and her husband is posted to Syria. This is before, some 20 years ago or more, before all the horrors of more recent years. And she managed, when living in Damascus, with the help of a large legacy, to buy a fine old house in the city. She describes it in detail and with delight. But 20 years later, is it still there? We don't know. And if it is, what condition is it in? We don't know that either. But we can be fairly sure, knowing what has happened more recently, that that much-loved house in Damascus is no longer the refuge which she thought she had bought all those years ago. And that's the trouble with this world, isn't it? You think you put your money somewhere good and safe, only to find that you were wrong. Now, so far in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus has been addressing the issue of religious hypocrisy, of piety, even Christian piety, which is superficial and shallow, which is designed to impress more than anything else, which is confined to external appearance. And in marked contrast to that, he has given us a picture of a life lived in secret before the Heavenly Father. Christian discipleship, though it is very evident by the good works that it results in, is essentially a secret thing before the Father, one in which God is known as Father, one in which his watchful eye is treasured, his presence and favor sought in secret behind the closed door. It is one in which the sacrifice and the hard work that his service involves are kept from others' eyes and the praise of other people. Father sees, Father knows, and Father will reward in his own way at his own time. And nothing more than that is needed, because Father is himself the essence of his reward. So that's what we've had so far in chapter 6. But now from verse 19 onwards, Jesus turns from the hypocrisy of the religious to the materialism of the irreligious. And he asks searching questions here about our own value system, about what really matters to us. He wants to know whether we who profess to follow him are really any different in our attitudes, our practice, our lifestyle, from those pleasant neighbors and colleagues whom we bump into all the time who make no Christian profession at all, as we were hearing from Nick, for instance, in the working day by day and all the pressures of working these days for the police. Are we any different underneath? Simple words, then, in verses 19 to 24, which is as far as we will get this morning. But they're very searching in their simplicity. What does Jesus call us to if we are his disciples? And the first thing we find ourselves called to in verses 19 and 20 is a heavenly focus. There is the first thing we find, a heavenly focus. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither wrath nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. A focus on heaven is a rarity these days. The assumption is that this world is the real one, and any other world, if it exists at all, is a bit of a distraction and not really much of a consequence, certainly not something to make the main thing. But Jesus Christ is of a different opinion. To him, heaven and hell, about both of which he speaks with great clarity, are every bit as real as life in this world, and we are foolish to think otherwise. He speaks of treasures on earth, on the one hand, and treasures in heaven, on the other, and he does so in the very same breath. And he is absolutely realistic about this present world. It can offer no lasting security, because in the world we live in is one in which moth and rust destroy, and thieves break in and steal. And this is undeniable, isn't it? Why am I wearing a blue pullover this morning? Well, because I got a new Well, I had it a while. I hadn't worn it before. A green pullover. I got it out a couple of weeks ago, nice and new, and a week later it had holes in it. That wretched moth. Doesn't seem to matter how many little protective things I put in the drawer. It's really annoying. And what about the thieves? Verse 19, they break in and steal. I can never read that phrase without thinking of the time and many years ago when I parked overnight by my brother's house opposite the Mile End Tube in London's East End. I'd done it a number of times before. It had been fine. It wasn't a very safe place, to be honest, but it had never been broken into before. But just to make sure that it wouldn't be again, my brother, with whom I was staying overnight and was a lively Christian, he laid his hands on my car, on the bonnet, and he prayed out loud and earnestly for angelic protection from any harm that might come to it. We went to bed quite happily. Next morning, somebody put a brick through the windscreen. It's fine to pray like that, but you can't guarantee safety by prayer, because Jesus says this is a world in which thieves break in and steal, and however much you pray about your car, that's not going to stop somebody putting a brick through the windscreen. Well, it may do. If God wants it to be kept that way, he will. But Jesus warns us this is reality. Moth and rust, decay all around us, corruption in the material world and corruption in the human heart. These are the two things that he's talking about. And they wreck everything sooner or later. Material security is very illusory. And even if we can protect things more effectively these days than they could in the first century, we still have no protection, do we, against the realities of inflation and of a financial crash and so on. There is no way of avoiding these things. And we are used to it. This is the world we live in, but of course it is not the world that God originally made, and it's not the world he desires us to live in. Imagine a world without keys. You got keys with you this morning? I've got a number of keys here. We wouldn't dream of living without keys. Do you lock your car? Do you lock your front door if you come to church on a Sunday? It'd be strange if you didn't. But imagine a world without one. We shouldn't need keys. It's just a reminder. We live in a fallen and a broken world in which moth and rust do destroy and where thieves break in and steal. That's the reality that Jesus talks about. So what is the point that he's making? Well, it's very simple, really. It's really here a question. Jesus says to us, why are you putting so much effort into things that you can't ultimately hold on to? Is that a sensible way to invest? He's asking us to think sensibly. This week, the chief executive of Persimmon Homes has been awarded and accepted a bonus of £75 million. It's a nice little package to tuck away. And he seems quite pleased about it. But is that really wise? One day he will die. And they will say, oh, yes, Jeff Fabban. I remember him. Yeah, did he leave a lot? And, oh, yes, the reply will be, he left it all. A shroud has no pockets, as somebody neatly observed. So is that really a sensible way to invest? Is that what you're about in this life? And in the meantime, does the money that you cling on to really bring happiness? Well, in a measure, possibly. But not really, according to Ivan Masso, who is another big-time entrepreneur, very successful man. He was asked in a fascinating newspaper interview, what the most important lesson was that he had learnt about money. And he replied, I've learnt that it doesn't buy you happiness, just a better quality of sadness. And Jesus says, that's what happens. If you lay up treasure for yourselves, treasures on earth, treasure for yourselves on earth. And he offers a better alternative, which is better by far, which is treasures in heaven, verse 20, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. It's very simple, and it's just common sense, really. Why put your effort into acquiring things you can only lose when you can put it into things that will only last? Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. What are these? Well, we mustn't misunderstand this. Somebody immediately might think, well, of course, this is about being so good that eventually I can earn my place in heaven. This is not about working your way to heaven as if to gain a place by merit. You ought to know that. It's probably worth saying anyway. Jesus is speaking here to his disciples, those who trust him and are following him. So it's nothing to do with being good enough for God. We are not. That's not the point. But speaking to his disciples, he says, be sure you are laying up for yourselves treasures in heaven. He doesn't define what those are, but John Stott is surely right to say, this must surely mean, laying up treasure in heaven must surely mean doing anything on earth whose effects last for eternity. Doing anything on earth whose effects last for eternity. Developing Christian character and known nearness and love for Christ. Because if heaven is about anything, it's about him. And the more nearer we are to him, the more we will want to be there. Developing our knowledge of Christ as Lord and doing all we can by prayer and witness to bring others to Christ, that they too can enjoy the eternal life, which is his gift. It means using money to Christian ends and Christian causes, and so on. Laying up treasure in heaven rather than on earth doesn't mean that you've got to live as a pauper. There's no great virtue in poverty of that kind in itself. It doesn't mean that it's wrong to own things, to enjoy them. It doesn't mean it's wrong to take out a mortgage responsibly. It doesn't mean that it's wrong to provide sensibly for your own future or for that of your dependents. It doesn't mean any of those things. But important as those daily concerns are, they are not the right focus for the Christian. That is the point. These are not the things that should matter most to us, because all these things one day will be left behind, because we live in a world where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. There is, therefore, great force in the words recorded in verse 21, where Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. In other words, your heart will follow your money and whatever you choose to spend it on. Take the latest iPhone, for instance. Don't know what that's going to be. I've lost count of where iPhones got up to. Mine's an iPhone 6, I think. I know there have been more. Let's look forward to the appearance of iPhone 15. Don't know whether it will be the one. Anyway, let's imagine the world. The great day of the iPhone 15 launch has come. You've been looking forward to it. You join your queue round the block to be one of the first to get yours. You take it home lovingly. You unwrap it. It's so beautifully presented, isn't it? They know how to do all that side of things. You open it up and you quickly encase it in protective coverings. And then you say to your friend, you want to see my new iPhone? And then they come and see, and you say, quickly, don't drop it, be careful, it's very precious to me. And so on. There's nothing wrong with having a good phone, just where we spend our money, our mind and heart tend to follow. Maybe on smaller things, maybe on large. You could equally give money to a Christian mission. And if you do, your heart will follow your money. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So take Bishop Stanley, we've been hearing about, wanting to support, and his work with his fellow workers in northern Tanzania. Take him just as an example. If you give secretly to him and his friends, I guarantee that your interest and your prayerful concern for him and his work will grow. You'll want to know how your investment is doing, how the gospel is growing out there, what the needs are that you can continue to support and to pray for. Where your treasure is, your heart will follow. Somehow, what we give for the sake of Christ, we never lose. We never lose what we've given away in his service. That's just true to experience, and it's what Jesus assures us will be the case. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in and steal. Financial advisors in this life are obliged to tell us that the value of our investments can go down as well as up. And this advisor tells us of investments that can never go down because they are secure, where no corruption of any kind can reach them. C.S. Lewis once said very shrewdly, aim at heaven and you'll get earth thrown in as well. Aim at earth and you'll get neither. So that's the first thing and the longest so far. Jesus calls us to a heavenly, not an earthly, focus. Second thing here that I find is a healthy eye. In verse 22, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? I have here a leaflet about an OCT eye scan, which I was given recently. OCT, it tells me, stands for Optical Coherence Tomography, and is a complex technology used to measure the eye and particularly the layers of the retina. An OCT scan is similar to an MRI or CAT scan for the eyes. OCT can image in 3D, allowing your practitioner to see problems within your eye that could not easily be seen before. It goes on to say, only 10 years ago, OCT technology was mainly used in research, but recent advances have brought this revolutionary technology into the forefront of eye care and into high street consulting rooms. Well, it's very persuasive. I was encouraged to have one of these things, and I had it. I seem to have passed for the moment. A healthy eye sees clearly. And Jesus stresses the importance of a healthy eye. There's much more at stake, of course, in what he's saying than the merely physical organ. The issue here is how you look at the world. It's what you do with an eye, isn't it? You look around. The issue, therefore, is about your attitude to what you see and who you see all around you. And a good and a healthy eye is a generous eye that loves to give. It's an eye that sees people and all that's around you in the world as an opportunity to serve. Whereas an unhealthy eye has a grasping spirit. It wants to acquire what it sees and then to retain it, not least at the expense of others. That's a very secondary importance. An unhealthy, a bad eye, has a niggardly and a grasping spirit. And that was the problem with Gehazi. We heard about in our earlier Old Testament Bible reading, Elisha's servant. Elisha the prophet has done this wonderful thing of enabling the healing of Naaman, the Syrian general, an enemy general really, and he's been healed of his leprosy, and he quietly refuses any reward. Naaman presses him, says, I will not touch a thing. This is God's doing. It's not for me to benefit. And Gehazi, the servant, sees this, goes, well, that won't do. I'm going to let him go. Can't do that. So he runs after him and says, oh, by the way, these extra three or four men have just arrived, so they're rather needy. They could do with a bag or two of this, that, and the other. And of course, Naaman says, well, of course, you know, have twice as much as you're asking for. And God says, well, great. He says, telling words, he said earlier, I will run after him and get something from him. That's the bad eye. I will run after him and get something from him. And at the end of the story, he has acquired what Naaman was delivered from. Naaman was cured of his leprosy. And Gehazi, spotted and uncovered by the prophet, ends with the leprosy that Naaman had lost. And Jesus says here of the bad eye, if you go like that, your whole body in time will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? In our visual world, we are bombarded with opportunities to be unhealthy in the way we look. The whole philosophy of advertising, as we know, is to make us unhappy. We were fine until we saw that advert, and then we said, I've got to get that. I must get one of those. And somebody might say, must you? Why? And you say, well, I want one. Oh, right, you want one. And so we drift through websites and we discover all sorts of interesting and desirable things that we didn't know about before. And we read the customer reviews with great care and build up our portfolio of acquisitions. Some of us may gloat over Hello magazine. Others prefer What Car or something else. But whatever our own preference, we drool. And Jesus says we have to be very, very careful about how we look at the world around us. If your essential attitude is a generous and a giving one, your whole body, your whole personality will be full of light. But if it's motivated by this kind of obsessive selfishness, your whole personality will become twisted and dark, and more so as the years go by. If the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? A friend of mine in Newcastle opened the door once to find a salesman on the other side of it. This guy was offering a very good deal on electricity supply, inviting my friend to sign up. Ian, my friend, was reluctant. There was a brief discussion until the salesman said, "But look, I can save you money." And Ian replied, "Saving money is not the chief object of my life." To which the salesman had no reply. He'd been very carefully trained to deal with all sorts of responses and take people on to the next step. But the people who trained him had not prepared for the eventuality of somebody saying, "Saving money is not the chief object of my life." And it led on, in fact, they forgot about the electricity deals and led on to a very useful discussion about Christianity and what could be the main object in that person's life. Going back to the OCT, I've forgotten what it is, optical coherence tomography. If you were to have a spiritual one this morning, what verdict would it come up with on your spiritual eye? Matthew Henry was a fine writer of a few centuries ago. This is how he reacted to the occasion on which he was robbed. He prayed and he said, "Lord, I thank you that I've never been robbed before. I thank you that though they took my money, they spared my life. That though they took everything, it wasn't very much. And I thank you that it was I who was robbed and not I who did the robbing." Now that's a healthy eye. It looks around with warmth and generosity of spirit in a damaged and a needy world. So Jesus calls us to a heavenly focus on the heavenly treasure, a healthy eye as we look around in the earthly life. And thirdly and lastly, he calls us in verse 24 to a crystal clarity. Verse 24 is very sobering. "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." And Jesus doesn't say that it is wrong to serve God and money. What he says is that it is impossible. It's like trying simultaneously to board trains that are going in opposite directions. Have you ever tried doing that? You could try it next time you're down at High Broom Station. There are two trains waiting. One is heading off to Charing Cross, the other is going to Hastings. Try boarding both of them at the same time. It'll be very difficult. In fact, it'll be impossible. And if you look around the station, will there be a sign saying persons attempting to climb onto two trains going in opposite directions at the same time will be liable to a £50 fine? Answer, probably not, because nobody would think of doing it because it can't be done. And Jesus says no one can serve, not no one should, but no one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. And despise is a significant word because, of course, these days the Christian way is despised more and more. People speak contemptuously of it. They speak contemptuously of this talk of treasures in heaven, that running away from the realities of life and so on. And it may be replied to this teaching that you can have two employers, actually, or more than two, in fact. Many people do. Well, yes, but employment is one thing, whereas slavery is another. And no owner in the ancient world shared a slave. Slavery meant single ownership and full-time service. That is the point, and that's what Jesus is speaking about. That is the term here. And he is calling for absolute and single-minded devotion. You cannot serve God and money. John Stott comments shrewdly in these words. "Some people disagree with this saying of Jesus. They refuse to be confronted with such a stark and outright choice, and they see no necessity for it. They blandly assure us that it is perfectly possible to serve two masters simultaneously, for they manage it very nicely themselves. Several possible arrangements and adjustments appeal to them. Either they serve God on Sundays and Mammon on weekdays, or God with their lips and Mammon with their hearts, or God in appearance and money in reality, or God with half their being and mammon with the other half. It is this popular compromise solution which Jesus declares to be impossible. Anybody who divides his allegiance between God and mammon has already given it to mammon, since God can only be served with an entire and exclusive devotion. This is simply because he is God. I am the Lord, that is my name, my glory I give to no other. To try to share him with other loyalties is to have opted for idolatry. No one can serve two. So a heavenly focus, a healthy eye, and crystal clarity about the issues. Rob Parsons, in a recent interview, gave two lovely examples of people who got this right. Rob is a very fine Christian man, one of the finest I've come across. A very fine Christian leader, getting on in years now, who pioneered a wonderful organization called Care for the Family. And I guarantee again that if you give to Care for the Family, such that it becomes your treasure, your heart will follow. He was asked what was the best example he had seen over the years of generosity in action. And he came up with two. His first example was that of Arthur and Margaret Tovey. When Rob was a teenager, he and his friends met in Arthur and Margaret's house for Bible study. Actually, it wasn't their house. They were very poor, couldn't afford a house of their own, so they lived with Arthur's mother. They had just two rooms in mother-in-law's house. But each week after the Bible study, Arthur and Margaret bought fish and chips for all the boys. And Rob only realized many years later what a major financial sacrifice that had been for them. The second are a couple he understandably chose not to name. Rob at this time was trying to raise money for a major project, and he needed almost £1 million. He decided to ring this couple. He was only on the phone to them for 2 minutes. The man said, "Leave it with us for a couple of days," and put the phone down. 2 days later, Rob received a short email saying they had decided to give him £500,000. And Rob comments, "A bag of chips, £500,000. I thank God with all my heart for both of them." One couple very rich, one couple very poor, but both had a heavenly focus, a healthy eye, and both of them could see the issues with absolute and crystal clarity.